Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of May. Some of you may have had a chance to see the New York Times Magazine piece yesterday on the moral life of babies, written by one of our guests, Paul Bloom. A growing body of evidence, he writes, suggests that humans do have a rudimentary moral sense from the very start of life. And with the help of well-designed experiments, you can see glimmers of moral thought, moral judgment, and moral feeling even in the first year of life. Some sense of good and evil seems to be bred in the bone, which is not to say that parents are wrong to concern themselves with moral development of that their interactions with their children are not a waste of time. Socialization is important, but this is not because babies and young children lack a sense of right and wrong. It's because the sense of right and wrong that they naturally possess diverges in important ways from what we adults would want it to be. We're going to talk about this fascinating issue this hour of the program today with two guests, Professor Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale University, who is the author of this piece. Professor Bloom, thank you very much for joining us today. It should be interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. And Kylie Hamlin is a PhD student at Yale University, researcher in the Infant Cognition Lab, and lead author of the Infant Morality Studies. Kylie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So tell us what the previous thought was, that babies had no morality?
Be thought by many people that morality is almost entirely learned. It's learned through parents, it's learned through culture. Children start off as, to some extent, little psychopaths with no sense of good and evil or guilt or shame. And a lot of our work, shows that that's mistaken.
So a lot of important psychiatrists and psychologists have held that belief for a long time.
Yeah, most recently, say Sigmund Freud or Jean Piaget, Lawrence Kohlberg. You know, they all argue, and it's not crazy to believe this, because children and babies really don't show much morality if you just observe them, particularly from a cynical eye. So they all argue that what we know about good and evil has to be learned.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the experiments that you set up. They are good guy, bad guy experiments, helping experiments, Kylie, and they're just so interesting, because you don't normally think that 6-month-olds or 7 or 10-month-old babies would respond this way or even could participate in such an experiment.
Right. So we basically just set up a bunch of different social scenarios that are fairly easy, but they all represent someone who has a particular goal that it can't solve on its own. So, for instance, trying to get to the top of a hill, or trying to open a box, or trying to play with a ball and sort of dropping one's ball. And then we just show the babies them being either helped or hindered in this goal by two additional characters. So one guy is sort of always helpful and another guy is sort of always unhelpful. And then we just simply ask them if they have a preference between the two characters at the end. So as an adult, when you're watching these little puppet interactions, it's very clear that one guy is nice and one guy is mean. And in order to ask whether babies think this too, we simply just saw which one they wanted to play with, basically.
And you found?
And we found sort of very robustly across the board, even starting, you know, as early as 3 months of age, that babies prefer the helpful puppets in all of these different interactions. Suggesting that even, you know, things, puppets they've never seen before and perhaps particular interactions they've never experienced, they're able to see it as positive and negative in the way that adults are.
At 3 months of age, ain't that something?
Yes.
Wow. And you also thought maybe it might be color at first, but you switched colors too.
Right. So, of course, all of our studies were really concerned with introducing any variables that would explain the baby's behavior that isn't the one of interest, in particular, whether they like nice guys or mean guys. So we do things like every other baby will see the yellow guy be nice or the blue guy be nice. We always change the sides of what they're seeing, the order of what they're seeing. So some babies see nice behavior first, some babies see mean behavior first, and then the side that they're presented on during the choice. The other thing that we do is make sure that the experimenters and the parents can't be influencing the kids either. So, of course, if we find that babies are doing something very cool, we want to be able to be sure that it's not that we're subtly influencing them in any way. So the experimenters don't know which puppet is which during the choice, and the parents also close their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So all the babies.
Were you surprised, Professor Bloom, to find this in 3-month-old babies? This is very young.
I was. In fact, when my collaborators, Kylie and Karen Wynn, wanted to go and test 3-month-olds, I was very skeptical. I thought it would be a waste of time.
Really?
You know, they're like lumps of oatmeal. They're like bread loaves. If you've ever seen a 3-month-old, it's astonishing they could do anything.
It is.
And I thought, even if they have the ability to recognize one character as good and another as bad, they wouldn't be able to show it. They wouldn't be able to show it in their reaching or their looking time or any aspect of behavior. And, you know, like usual, I'm just entirely mistaken. They give us sort of very striking and powerful results.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your interest in this area. You write in the piece yesterday, I've long been fascinated by the capacities and inclinations of babies and children. What fascinated you, and what are the ramifications of learning what you have learned from these studies?
Well, I think, you know, as I say in the piece, I'm admittedly biased, but I think that the baby studies are one of the great discoveries of our time. Other investigators have found that the youngest of babies have a rich understanding of the physical world and the psychological world, the world of objects and the world of people. And this was a natural next step, to look at morality, to look at good and evil. And it connects with so many interesting issues. It connects with issues about theology and the role of religion and the shaping of morality. It connects with evolutionary biology and why how our species have evolved to be so nice. And so it was a natural next step with Karen and with Kylie to look at their sense of good and evil. You asked about implications, and I'm not actually sure that this has implications for how we should raise our kids. I'm not sure this is stuff that parents need to sort of alert themselves to and change what they're doing. But I see this work, the work done in our lab and the work done in many other labs, as having real important implications for how we think about human nature.
Mm-hmm. And you, I'm wondering how you came up with this particular experiment. Paul writes in the article that for a long time, scientists really weren't sure how to go about studying the mental life of babies. I would imagine it's quite a challenge to do that, Kylie. How did you come up with an experiment that would show, that would be a scientific experiment, and why has it been so hard prior to now, or maybe prior to you, to study the mental life of babies?
Well, many psychologists over the last 20 or 30 years or so have figured out very clever ways to study the mental life of babies. One way is to measure what they want to look at. So like adults, if you can imagine that when an adult sort of passes something that it finds peculiar or inconsistent with sort of regular everyday life, they might stop and look at it and try and figure out what's going on. Well, it turns out that babies do this too. If you show them sort of impossible events, for instance, a object hanging in midair not seeming to be governed by the rules of gravity, babies will look longer at that event than an object that is resting on a table that is governed by the rules of gravity. So it turns out that babies sort of give us some evidence of what they're thinking based on how long they look at something, the idea being that they look longer at things that they find inconsistent or weird. Another way that that psychologists have developed to study what babies are thinking is preference. So given sort of two pictures, one being more exciting than the other, babies tend to look longer at the more exciting one. And they also tend to look longer at attractive faces versus unattractive faces and things like that. And so with our studies, we were able to show them these interactions and just simply use their preference for one actor over the other in order to try and get at what they're thinking about the characters.
Hmm. Dr. Bloom, you also talk about the new studies finding that babies have an actual understanding of mental life. They have some grasp of how people think and why they act as they do.
Yes. So a lot of the backdrop from this work is a series of studies showing that at a surprisingly young age, babies seem to understand other people have minds. So they understand that other people have goals, and they expect people to pursue their goals, and they're surprised when somebody does something that makes no sense. In some very striking studies, it's been found that babies before, say, their second birthday, understand that other people have beliefs and that these beliefs can be false. So they expect you to act based on how you think the world is, which might be different from how the world actually is. And all of this points to a very sophisticated understanding of other people emerging quite early, and we think universally.
Isn't that something? We understand all of that, and we can't really say it. We just know it in our heads.
Exactly. So babies can't talk. Obviously, they can't talk about what they know. And I'm skeptical as to whether they could consciously ruminate or deliberate what they know. They just know it. I think that a lot of it feels to them instinctive, as instinct, as a sort of unconscious appreciation of what's going on. And I think that's true in the domain of morality as well. So we find in our studies babies have these preferences. Their understanding runs quite deep, involving reward and punishment and justice and fairness. But I don't think they ruminate over these things. I think they just feel them.
It's hard to imagine our ruminating about those, because I guess we were all babies at one time.
And I think we retain the baby's way of seeing the world. But in addition, we can talk about things and change
right.
our minds.
Yeah, I wish we could talk about our ruminations when we were that age. What about, are you able to add the element of how the babies are treated and how that may influence their sense of what's right and what's wrong? If they're neglected, if people don't tend to them when they're crying, is there a way to add that element?
It's a good question. In principle, it would be if you tested a wide range of babies and you gave them tests where babies vary a lot. You could then look to see why some babies do this and other babies do that. And you could link it up to, on the one hand, to how the babies are raised, on the other hand, possible genetic differences between babies. We know babies have different temperaments and different styles of interactions. That's partially genetic. And maybe this genetic influence extends to moral judgments and moral attitudes. In our own research, our methods are not the sort that could find that. We test small groups of babies. Our results tend to be very strong. And the good part about that is that it tells us something really interesting and universal. The bad part is that if virtually all the babies do something, it's not a good measure for talking about human differences.
Interesting. Kylie, I'm interested, Dr. Bloom asked this question in the piece, and let's spend some time on this. If babies have such a rich understanding of objects and people so early in life, why do they seem so ignorant and helpless? Can we answer that?
Well, I think one of the reasons they seem so ignorant and helpless is because physically they absolutely are. Despite the fact that a baby may be able to judge that one guy is good and another guy is bad, it really has no bearing on their ability to, for instance, escape or do much in terms of actually influencing their social interactions. So it may be that the babies are sort of coming to the world with these abilities, but that they're not really using them for any good yet at a very young age. And until they're able to physically use these abilities to influence their lives, we're not really seeing any development from them. On the other hand, we have been looking into whether babies are using their abilities to influence themselves, so, for instance, to learn about the world. So one of the things that we do, of course, as adults is to we like certain individuals and we dislike other individuals, but we also want to be like those individuals that we like. And what we're finding is that babies might actually be showing these effects as well, that they may be preferentially learning from or preferentially copying individuals that they like in the world, which actually might be a real online effect of these judgments that we could see even in infants.
Copying in what way?
Matching the preferences is what we're looking at so far. So if they see nice individuals like one thing, they tend to copy what they like and avoid what they dislike. Mm. But if they see not so nice individuals like one thing, they tend to totally ignore that information and not want to be like that not nice individual.
Interesting. How do you answer your own question? If babies have such a rich understanding of objects and people, why are they so ignorant and helpless? Paul?
I agree with Kylie's second idea, which is I think that they use this knowledge not to, not to start fights or avoid people because they can't, but they use this knowledge to help them learn. They use their moral appreciation and their appreciation more generally to know who to pay attention to know who to listen to, who to learn from, how to react. And I think in general, one of the reasons why we're sort of blessed with this extraordinary understanding so early on is that it helps us learn more about the world. So, people used to think that innate knowledge, hardwired knowledge, and cultural learning are somehow opposed to each other, as in two alternative theories of human nature. But in fact, this innate knowledge makes cultural learning possible. Your baby's a great learner because your baby starts off knowing so much.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the moral life of babies and some remarkable experiments that have been done by our guests. Kylie Hamlin is a PhD student at Yale University and a researcher in the Infant Cognition Lab, lead author of the Infant Morality Studies. Dr. Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University and is author of the piece that was in yesterday's New York Times magazine. And he also has a book coming out just a month from now on how pleasure works, the new science of why we like what we like. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have tons of phone calls coming in, so let's go right to them. Camille from Frankfurt, our first caller. Hi, Camille.
Hi.
Hi.
To go in a slightly different direction, I just wanted to add that Rudolf Steiner, the founder of the Waldorf School, spoke of children as coming in with an innate sense that their needs will be met. And which is, in a sense, consistent with everything I'm hearing here. And it also makes me wonder, too, though, how that affects a child whose needs are not being met, and how it may take so long for a child to, for that to become conscious for a child. I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks, Camille. Dr. Bloom, you want to start?
That's an interesting comment. I think to some extent the point is right. Babies start off with built-in expectations about their needs, as well as different strategies for getting them. That's why babies cry. That's why babies have different sorts of smiles, as a way to manipulate parents into doing into helping them out. The question of the relationship between a baby's environmental history of his parents and how they make sense of these different interactions is a great one. There's some work that's been done at Stanford by Carol Dweck and Susan Johnson and her colleagues looking at using very similar setups to the one that Kylie described and seeing how babies with different sorts of histories with their parents react to characters that move in different ways. And they find that these babies have different expectations. They expect more. The babies who've been treated well expect more helping to go back and forth, while the other babies, unfortunately, don't.
Hmm. How did you determine, was there a way to screen these babies at all, Kylie? How did you determine which babies were going to be helpful and which babies maybe were just hungry and they were going to cry during this and not take the experiment seriously?
Right, right. So, of course, we, you know, thankfully get parents to bring in their babies when they're fed and slept and all happy and adorable. But basically, you know, any study of babies has a fair amount of attrition just due to, you know, them being babies, them changing from quite happy to quite unhappy and, you know, quite quickly. But actually with these studies, we found a very low level of that. So infants actually incredibly enjoy watching these puppet shows. They tend to, when they get old enough, they tend to clap and laugh and they really sort of interact almost with the puppets while they're doing their little thing. So we have low level of lost babies in these studies due to fussiness. And other than that, we just tend to study babies who are at full term of development, but that's the only real criterion we have.
Hmm. Let's go to Mary from Minnesota. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just have a question about the helplessness of babies, and I think some of the problem is as adults, we don't tune in to what they want. And a lot of times we fail to look at, because they can't escape, they do look away when they've lost interest or they're tired or they become fussy or they cry. and even as young as 6 weeks. And I think that we as adults fail to recognize those signals that they give us. And I'd like to know if the people have taken that into consideration, that we as adults need to tune in to their signals.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Dr. Bloom?
I think that's an interesting point. I guess what I'll say is that the one set of adults that do pay attention to these signals are developmental psychologists, because I think parents might differ in their ability to make sense of how their babies are responding. But we use these responses as very revealing cues to going into what goes on in the baby's mind. And this sort of infant cognitive psychology is only possible because babies can indicate through these cues to a sensitive enough observer what's going on in their heads.
I was interested in the experiments that you've done relating to pain, that evidently we can feel the pain of others pretty early in our lives. Kylie?
Well, these are not our experiments, but what some very interesting studies have found is that even newborn babies are sensitive to the cries of other babies. So if you play a tape of a baby crying to a newborn, they themselves will cry as though they're seemingly getting upset. The most interesting part of these studies are that these babies do not cry when they're played a tape of their own cries, as though they're not concerned when they hear crying in itself, but they're actually concerned about the distress or pain of others, and so cry to others' cries.
Hmm. We go next to Leah from Green Bay. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hi.
I actually have two questions. One is, we see ourselves as different from animals because of our spiritual dimensions, and I wondered if there was any thought of trying these experiments with chimpanzees or our cousins to see if the same moral development shows up. And second of all, I wonder if you did a longitudinal study of the babies that didn't choose the positive puppet, whether that would predict psychopaths.
Oh, that's interesting. Dr. Bloom?
Those are both things which we've sort of been thinking about in different ways. So we've done some work in collaboration with Lori Santos looking at how capuchin monkeys respond to the same situations. And Kylie can correct me if this is wrong, but I think the results right now suggest do not provide any reason to believe that non-human primates have the same sort of rich understanding human babies have. I should add, I don't really think this is so much of a spiritual dimension, but rather just an evolutionary adaptation that might be special to humans and not show up in other creatures. The question of those babies who don't respond the way we expect them to, who might choose the bad guy, for instance, or want to punish the good person, is an interesting one. It might well be that this is a different sort of baby, a baby who will grow up to be a different sort of child and a different sort of adult. On the other hand, it's hard to know. It might just be that these are the babies who don't pay attention or who turn their head at a critical moment or who just feel mischievous. And, again, that's the sort of thing, if you have very large sample sizes and the serious, you know, studies looking at human variation, it could shed some light on this question. But right now, it's a very open question.
Kylie, you were going to respond to something here, too.
I was, actually. So so we have run these studies on not capuchin monkeys, but actually rhesus macaque monkeys. So our very nearest monkey relatives outside of the ape tree. And what we do find is actually that they respond to these situations not exactly as babies do, but as though they understand them as social interactions and as positive and negative in some ways. So what we find is that instead of monkeys preferring or tracking the nice puppets, which is what we find that babies do, they actually seem to pay more attention to the mean puppets. So they tend to look at them more and maybe track them, potentially because there is more important for a monkey who lives in the wild to track threat. So they tend to look longer at the threatening puppet, significantly longer than they do at the nice puppet, perhaps because they're tracking threat. So I think actually we are finding evidence that in subtly different ways, but still that they are understanding these interactions as important ones.
Right. What about soothing people? You have to be a certain age to be able to do this, but I know you've looked at baby's ability to reach out and touch and comfort another baby who may be in pain.
This is some wonderful work, not done in our lab, but done in other labs, that show spontaneous kindness to others. Even a baby around his or her first birthday, when they see somebody in pain, might caress the person or maybe hand over a bottle or a toy. And there's been some more recent work by Felix Varnik and Michael Tomasello looking with toddlers at when toddlers will help others. And again, you find the spontaneous helping of strangers showing up very early in development. And it's not as simple as we're naturally good. I mean, at times we could be naturally pretty rotten. But the capacity for good, the capacity for selfless intervention, does seem to show up spontaneously in humans.
We go to Lisa from Madison next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guests could comment on what's going on in young children's minds when they manifest extreme fear to clowns or say humans dressed up as characters. I remember being in Disney World once and thinking it was torturous for these children being pushed around in strollers and having these giant Disney characters approach them. And a third example would be kids who have birthday parties and then some adult will dress up as Spider-Man or some other character. Characters that the children see in cartoons and are okay with, but once they come alive, they're terrified. I don't understand what's going on there.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, Lisa. Who wants to take that?
Well, it's very far from anything I study, but that's not going to stop me.
Well, good. Then you're a perfect talk show guest.
Exactly. Psychologists talk about the uncanny valley, and this is a technical term for things that are not one thing, and they're not another either. So babies are perfectly comfortable with people, and they're perfectly comfortable with many animals and many cartoon characters. But it might be that the things that are in the middle scare us. They scare us as children. They scare us as adults. And one example of something that's in the middle would be like a zombie or a vampire. But a different example would be a clown. A clown is very much of a person, but their face is marked up and very much does not a person. And that can be very disturbing. You don't know where to put the category. It might be threatening. And then it might give rise to an extremely fearful response.
Hmm. You want to respond to that, Kylie?
Sure. I think one of the things about clowns or anything that's wearing a mask is that it can be very unpredictable. So babies, what we find is they're very good at predicting what other people are going to do. But it turns out that if you're wearing a bunch of face paint that, you know, keeps you with sort of a static facial expression, or you're wearing a mask, it might be that babies' cues as to what people are going to do are taken away from them, and this could possibly be a very threatening experience. You know, if you're used to being able to predict others' actions based on their facial expressions, et cetera, and then you lose that ability, I can imagine that being quite scary if you're just a little baby.
Hmm.
I'll just add in support of what Kylie just said, that a classic demonstration in psychology is you look at a baby, you interact with the baby, and then you stop and you freeze your face. It's called a still face. You don't make any expressions. And when babies see this, they freak out. They get
really
very upset. And I think it's because suddenly the face is no longer a face. You can't read its intentions. You don't know what's going on. And it's extremely upsetting.
Huh. Let's go to an email. Start with you for a response, Kylie. How do you make sure that the infant prefers a given puppet because of the good moral characteristics of the puppet versus the puppet being a nicer playmate?
Well, I mean, in some ways, our moral judgments as adults are not always very distinct from them, you know, being a nicer playmate. But one of the things is that, importantly, in all of our studies, the babies are not involved in the puppet interactions. So they just are sort of observing them from afar, and they so if they're making judgments about the niceness and meanness of these characters, it's because it's based on the characters interacting with other individuals, so not interacting with the babies. But that said, it's a fair point that Maybe they think that if someone is nice to someone else, that the puppet will also be nice to them in the future. And I think that this wouldn't necessarily be a problem for our opinions about what the babies are doing here. One of the things that is especially interesting that we find that was touched on somewhat in the article is that babies don't always like those who are nice across the board. We've been studying punishment, and it turns out that if babies see someone as deserving of bad treatment, for instance, if they were mean to a different character before, babies actually prefer those who are mean to them, suggesting they think they deserve bad behavior for what they had done before. So it doesn't seem like babies always like those who are nice. They actually seem to have some concept of justice and who deserves what.
Hmm. And how young does that start?
That the youngest we've tested that is at 8 months, but we find very robust effects at that age as well. So seemingly right from the get-go.
Wow. And how did you set that up? How do you look at punishment?
So it's basically very similar to our other studies in which we have puppet shows in which there's a nice guy and a naughty guy, except we just show babies a second puppet show after that. For half the babies, they see a character who was previously nice be then rewarded and punished. So in just a second interaction of niceness and meanness, if you think about it in rewarding and punishing terms, basically either the former nice guy is rewarded and punished or the former mean guy is rewarded and punished. In the nice guy case being rewarded and punished, we find that babies like the rewarding puppets, so the ones who are nice to the nice guy. This isn't that surprising, though, because we find all the time that babies like pro-social individuals in general. What was particularly striking, however, is that when we pit generally nice behavior versus mean behavior of a deserving individual, so someone who was bad before and potentially deserves punishment, babies actually have no trouble with this, but they strongly prefer the punisher. They prefer a punisher of a bad guy over someone who's nice to the bad guy, suggesting that nice behavior is not always what they want others to do. They seem to be of evaluating what others deserve and liking those who treat them accordingly.
Hmm. Mike from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
My pet dog can tell whether I'm in a bad mood or a good mood. It's no big deal. When a baby's born, its brain isn't even hooked up yet. In fact, that goes all the way up until 20s, I read somewhere. And so consequently, a baby's afraid of loud noises. So if the baby in the crib next to it starts yelling, I suppose it's going to disturb the baby next to it. And it's afraid of falling. Those were the only two fears that seemed to be innate. So is it possible that all the rest of it is just conditioned response? You know, every living organism on the planet, including microorganisms, have a need to eat to survive. Maslow's hierarchy of needs points out that survival is right on the bottom. So it only makes good sense that the amygdala or the limbic system or the more primitive parts of the brain are hooked up first, which, of course, are the emotional centers. So I'd like to have your comment.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Dr. Bloom, you want to start?
I didn't quite catch all of that, but at the end he was talking about arguing for the emotional basis of morals for children, for
mm-hmm.
babies. Is that right? I lost the first half of this question, unfortunately.
I'm sorry. Yeah, take it from there.
I think that I would sort of half agree with that, which is that the reactions our babies show are not these cold-blooded, rational assessments. They're you could tell by watching the babies respond that they sort of root on the good guy, and they're kind of annoyed at the bad guy. We have a lovely video of one baby leaning over and smacking a bad guy in the head.
Ooh!
So these are not cold-blooded responses. They are very emotional. But I would also add that they're very smart, too. They're based on this quite subtle and rich appreciation of goals and behaviors, of what it is to help somebody, what it is to hinder them. So I think what we see in babies is a nice blend of the rational and the emotional.
Do you want to respond to that, Kylie?
Sure, and maybe I could speak a little bit more to the beginning of the question, which dealt with whether or not all of these things are based on some very basic drives to survive. And it may very well be the case that that's what babies are doing. They may see threatening individuals in the world and wish to avoid them in order to aid in their own survival. So, you know, it's up to interpretation as to how far we take the sort of judgment of morality. But what we really are finding is that, Professor Bloom said, that babies are able to take a lot of kinds of information into account when they're making these survival judgments. So, for instance, what somebody wanted, who wanted to help them, who wanted to block them, how they went about doing that, what was the context in which these things occurred, was it deserving, was it undeserved treatment, et cetera. So it seems like even if what they're doing is at some level, you know, I want to hang out with those who are going to be nice to me, that this kind of calculation that they're doing is quite complex.
What studies, I was interested in the studies that have found, and I think that these might be a little bit older, that some of our moral sense is biased toward those who are like us, who share the same color of skin, who share the same language, etc. So is our sense of morality pretty narrow here, Professor Bloom?
I think it is. I think it tells you something about the limits of our natural morality. There's a lot of studies, some of them very old, some of them just ongoing, that shows that the moral understanding both of adults and children, but also of babies, is narrow. Our immediate impulse is to care more about those around us and those who look like us and those who share our skin color and our facial features than strangers in faraway lands. And even for babies, you find this preference. Say you find this preference for people who speak their language, or who speak without an accent. And this is, you know, for fairly young babies. And I think this preference translates to a sort of moral favoritism towards the in-group. And it speaks to why we're more than big babies, or why we should aspire to be more, which is part of having a mature moral system is overriding this. We might be naturally predisposed to favor our own race morally versus other races or other ethnicities, but we know that we shouldn't. And we could try to override this sense.
And that's where, to develop further, we need what?
Rationality, deliberation, the ability to take the perspective of other people, the ability to think, look, that person is in a different, looks different from me, is in a different situation, but he's still a person. And I could imagine what it would be like from his point of view. And I could imagine that he loves his life and his privileges and his freedoms every bit as much as I do. And in that way, we could expand our moral circle.
Hmm. More phone calls for our guests in a moment. We're talking about the moral life of babies, the subject treated in a very interesting piece written by one of our guests, Paul Bloom, in yesterday's New York Times Magazine section. Our guests are Paul Bloom, who's a professor of psychology at Yale University and author of a book that will be released very soon, in June, actually. And it is on How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Kylie Hamlin is a PhD student at Yale, researcher in the Infant Cognition Lab, and lead author of the Infant Morality Studies. Here's our phone number. Our lines have been busy, but they're free now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 8655. The email address, if you'd like to send us one of those, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email talk@wpr.org. Christy Peace is our on-air producer, and she'll be answering your phone calls and getting you on the air very shortly. And the piece, in case you want to find it, you can go online today. It's the New York Times, The Moral Life of Babies. It was in yesterday's New York Times Magazine section, and it is written by Paul Bloom, who is one of our guests this hour. 800-486-8655. I think, Professor Bloom, you mentioned religion earlier in this program. What has been the role of religion in times past for dealing with morality and babies, and what are the implications for religious studies when you look at these aspects of morality in babies?
Well, you could take the question two ways. One thing is, what is the these baby findings tell us about religious questions. And to some extent, I think they're sort of neutral. Many religions incorporate the idea that babies are naturally good, or humans have a natural goodness, something to conflict with our original sin, maybe. And to some extent, our results would support that. Our results support a feature of humans that that many religions would endorse. The second question, which many people ask, is what is the role of religion in instilling morality? And what we find at minimum is that you could have a lot of morality without religion. Long before children are raised in any religious context, they show, I think, a fairly rich understanding of good and evil. And this fits in with other work suggesting that even for adults across cultures, how religious you are has little to do with whether or not you have a moral sense or moral understanding. It's fully possible to have morality without religion. Now, religion can shape morality in some ways, both good and evil, but our results suggest in general that that is not a necessary part.
Hmm. Let's go to Gay from Madison. Hi, Gay.
Yes, hi. I had a couple of questions. First of all, I just read the article last night. It was really interesting to me. As I read it, I wondered about the experiment itself or some of the experiments. I wondered how they controlled for left or right-handedness in terms of what babies reached for. I know how they controlled for attraction to a certain color, the variable of attraction to a certain color. You explained that in the article. But I wondered about that. And the other thing is the use of the terms good and evil really do still bother me, though I understand how nuanced you were, in the nuanced way in which you were using it in the article. And in the experiments, but isn't it rather culturally bound to what's defined as selfishness and what is defined as just self-interest that doesn't have a sort of moral judgment on it?
Hmm.
Or is this really a universal concept?
So to answer the first question,
the
experiments are designed so that if a baby has a bias, say, to reach for the right, it won't lead to better performance. So there's no way that babies could show off moral knowledge, but actually simply be showing a hand favoritism. If anything, for our reaching studies, if babies always prefer to reach in one direction, it would mess up our results, and you would expect the findings not to work out at all.
Kylie? I'm sorry, you're not finished.
The second issue was over the notion of good and evil. To some extent, good and evil is culturally related. In some societies, homosexuality is evil, in others it's not. There's different views about abortion and all sorts of things. But I think there is a core universal notion of good and evil involving the fundamental treatment of others. And so that's sort of what we're talking about when we talk about good and evil understanding emerging in young babies.
You want to add to that at all, Kylie?
The basic thing about the handedness issue is that we always switch the sides that the characters are on. So if they were to reach the right every time, they would fail as a group to show the effects that we're finding. Interestingly, we often get babies reaching with their dominant hand. They just reach across their body and go for the guy on the left if he was the nice one.
Oh, interesting. Let's go to Pam from Appleton. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
This is a great discussion. I'm fascinated. And the reason is because both of my children were adopted from China. My son is a toddler, but my daughter is a 10-month-old. And as I'm listening to you say that children have a natural bias toward people who look the same and that sort of thing, as an adoptive parent, you're counseled that your child is going to go through changes, obviously, a new culture, a new language, food, but this child's parents look different, they speak differently. And so I'm wondering if there's any evidence as to what these children are thinking as infants who are handed over to people who don't look the same. And so, are they, is going through their minds as they are sort of handed into this totally foreign existence?
Hmm. Professor Bloom.
It's a fascinating issue. My bet is that young children, young babies, and even maybe older babies, don't really know what they themselves look like.
Okay.
They don't know. So when they favor a group, it's not because they know that they're a member of the group. Rather, what they know is they know what the people around them look like. Mm-hmm. And typically that's the same. So I think a child who was adopted as a baby, for instance, would develop precisely the same preferences early on as any other child raised in that culture.
Oh.
Later on, though, when children will recognize that they have a certain group and ethnicity and look that might be different from those people around them, it raises some very interesting questions about questions that I think have been addressed well by a lot of social psychologists about where you put yourself and how you categorize yourself. And those are some interesting struggles that adopted children often have to go through.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pam, so much for the call. Again, Kylie, feel free to respond.
So actually, just to point out, one of the, I think, very coolest studies along these lines lately has shown that while young babies do prefer to look at faces of their own race, it seems to only be the case for babies who are raised in homogeneous racial environments,
oh.
So around all of one particular race. So babies, for instance, in cultures in which there are many races, they do not seem to show the preference for their own race early on, and if they do develop it, it develops much later. So it seems to be that these kinds of preferences that were developing so early may be just the basis of what's familiar to you. And so, of course, as an adoptive child in a a different race home, that home environment is going to be what's familiar.
Oh, that's very interesting. Here's an email that's come in. Yesterday, I visited my 91-year-old mom at the Alzheimer unit of the nursing home. Talking of babies, each one of the ladies in that unit are given a doll that looks like a real live baby. I thought this was interesting that these dolls gave the women comfort. Alzheimer's patients are caring for someone again. Well, at least my mom finds comfort in her new baby. Very comforting to me also to see my mom happy with that new baby. Dr. Bloom.
It's a lovely story. A lot of our interest in this lab with me and Karen Wynn and Kylie is with babies, from the baby's point of view, how the baby sees the world. But there's a flip side, which is how we respond to babies. And I think our responses to babies are just fascinating. And often the emotional contact with a baby, or even somebody, something that's sort of a baby, can be profoundly soothing. And lead to all sorts of positive feelings. We've been wired up to be very moved by babies, and I think it's why this topic fascinates so many people. So that's just a great story of how somebody can use that fact to really help somebody's life.
Right. I'd like to see a study on that. Isn't that a great story, Kylie?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, very, very nice. So what do we do with all of this knowledge? When you studied this in the lab and made these findings, it made you want to go out and what?
I don't know. Go on the radio.
Give them harder questions.
to be a bit cautious, I should emphasize, this doesn't mean parents are doing anything wrong or that they're doing anything right. It doesn't... I think we interact with our babies in certain ways that turns out to be, for the most part, the right way to interact with our babies. I think the benefits of this work, or the excitement of this work, is on the one hand what it tells us about the science and these sort of questions which I think everybody's interested in. And on the other hand, if you have a baby, if you have a child at home, I just find it's just amazing to look at them and know what's going on in their heads.
It's always amazing to just look at babies, isn't it? It's funny. People can just spend hours just looking.
I hear there's a new movie out on that.
Oh, there is. Have you seen it? Yeah, I saw a news clip on it.
Not yet, but I promise.
I've seen it.
Good.
It's wonderful.
Is it wonderful, Kylie?
It really is, yeah.
Is it?
And it's just really 2 hours of just, you know, clips of babies thinking and doing their thing, and it's really magical.
Oh, I'll have to see it. That sounds wonderful. Well, best of luck to you. I understand you just got your PhD. Congratulations. And you're going to the University of British Columbia.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, that's a nice place to be.
Yes.
Darn beautiful it is. I want to thank both of you so much for a really extraordinarily interesting hour. Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Our great pleasure. Our guest, Paul Bloom, wrote the piece. It's in yesterday's New York Times. You can get access to it on the web, The Moral Life of Babies. He's a professor of psychology at Yale University and author of the book that will be released in June, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Also joining us this hour, Kylie Hamlin, who's just received her PhD from Yale University and is heading to the University of British Columbia starting this fall. She is the researcher in the Infant Cognition Lab and lead author of the Infant Morality Studies, which have been outlined, their studies and others, in Paul's piece in the Times yesterday. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for producing this program, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have great conversations ahead, so please stay with the station, and we'll be with you again tomorrow.